Okay, let's continue. So, paper 7D deals with some detailed aspects of transition and practical expedience. In response to issues referred to the board by the TRG, the IASB has proposed to amend the transition requirements in two respects. Firstly, to extend the use of hindsight from variable consideration to the topic of modifications, and secondly, to amend when practical expedience relating to so-called completed contracts apply. And for the purposes of transition, a completed contract is one for which the entities transferred all of the goods or services in accordance with the previous GAAP. However, of course, under previous GAAP, revenue may have been deferred. So at the point that IFRS 15 is effective, under the previous GAAP, some revenue may not have been recognised. Overall, the amendments the IASB has proposed are substantially, but not entirely, converged with the FASB proposals, and the feedback that we've had from constituents was largely favourable in principle. Many respondents urged the boards to remain converged. However, most of them didn't express a preference between the IASB and the FASB proposals. So essentially, the task is to balance four conflicting factors. Operational efficiency for the preparers who are transitioning to a complex new standard, the fact that increasing the number of practical expedients actually increases complexity. It's generally desirable to retain hard-won convergence where this is possible, but not at any price. And the ISB, as we all know, has a high hurdle for making amendments. With that as a background, the staff recommendations are as follows. First of all, on completed contracts under the full retrospective transition method, we recommend permitting entities that apply this not to restate completed contracts. At present, the practical expedient for completed contracts only applies to the modified retrospective method. At present, entities that apply the full retrospective method must restate all contracts. So this would give errors an extra option. Second area is the use of hindsight when looking at modifications, and we recommend that the ISB confirms the hindsight practical expedient, so entities can evaluate historic modifications by applying hindsight to the position on the contract, only up to the date of initial application, obviously. And secondly, we recommend, the staff recommends, that the ISB permits entities using the modified retrospective method to apply it at either the beginning of the earliest comparative period, which was the date in the ISB exposure draft proposal, or alternatively, the later date of initial application, which was the different and later FASB date. And the rationale is that permitting either date will promote operational efficiency for dual reporters and a measure of convergence. And while the two dates may give rise to different prospective revenue profiles after the date of initial application, if there are modifications during the comparative period, we really don't believe that any differences would be significant. It's simply about how you do the mechanics of a known calculation. The third area relates to completed contracts, and it relates to the modified retrospective method. Here we recommend that entities are permitted not to apply this method to completed contracts. This is something that the FASB proposed, and the ISB originally did not, but we did have comments from some respondents that it would be a useful expedient. If we did this, it would be symmetrical with the full retrospective method, assuming the board agrees the proposal I outlined above, and obviously it would promote convergence. And then the last area is in the definition of a completed contract. The FASB proposes redefining this as a contract for which all or substantially all of the revenue was recognised under legacy GAAP before the date of initial application. What the FASB new definition would mean is it would avoid the issue of outstanding revenue on completed contracts, which by definition wouldn't exist, but it would reduce the number of completed contracts that are eligible for expedient. The staff do not recommend the IASB conform its definition, Essentially, some people have already early adopted, and obviously this would be difficult for them. There is a high hurdle for changes, and the ISB's already decided in September not to do this. The arguments on this one we think are quite finely balanced. If, and I stress if, the ISB wants to assist dual listed entities and promote convergence to some extent, the ISB could allow entities to use either definition. That would be analogous to the proposal on the modifications date recommendation, for instance. By definition, it's going to be transitory. It'll only apply to live contracts during the transition period. On balance, because of the high hurdle for changes, the staff don't recommend this. We feel entities could avoid the tensions between the two different definitions, assuming the FASB changes, simply by not excluding completed contracts from the modified or the modified retrospective method, though obviously they then have to reevaluate more contracts. So, finally based decision, lots of moving parts. And turn it over to Paul.
So, should we just do this question by question?
Yeah, let's do that question by question.
So, the first area is the full retrospective completed contracts, practical expedient. So it's the question after paragraph 19.
Do we wish to confirm that approach? Okay.
The next area is the contract modification practice expedient. So the first question is asking to confirm practical expedient in principle. And then the second question is saying, do you agree with the recommendation about effectively introducing some optionality in which date that expedient can be applied? I don't know whether anybody's got any comments on those, first of all.
Henry, on that one, that's for important to those who are dual quarters, primarily the use either date, or is it more important than or more applicable to
I think it's wider than that. I think the problem is that there are two people who would have a strong view on this, and they would prefer one or the other. I mean, there are entities who have many, perhaps millions of customers that have frequent modifications. I mean, telcos is one example, but there are others, IT, for instance. They will wish to adopt a systems solution to this, because trying to do something like this manually is just impracticable. And they would prefer to be able to start now, set up a system, and then the system tracks the modifications as they happen. It's going to be difficult for them to wait until the date of initial application and then get some numbers out for their next quarterly results. So they would prefer the earlier date. On the other hand, if you don't have many modifications, or they aren't very frequent, you'd prefer to wait until later, so that you only have to do the recalculation then. So that's the reason that we...
Two bipolar extremes,
yes.
And therefore the choices,
that's
rather than specifying either or.
Yes. Or allowing kind of Liberty Hall, where people could, quote, game the system, but it's hard to see what difference it would make. But
I agree. I mean, the self-corrects quick enough.
Yeah. Yes. I think that's the important point, is that although there is some relief here, you're still having to work. It's just a case of when do you work through the modifications that have taken place to that contract. So it is hard to see that it would have any significant effect, and it's transitory.
I had a question. Stuart, and I'm supportive or vote yes to both of these, but I just wanted to confirm, and you partially answered my question, and that is, with respect to those industries where it is actually beneficial to start earlier, is that preference irrespective of the jurisdiction, in other words, across oceans? Telcos across the world prefer, for example, to start earlier versus other industries that are indifferent and can start later?
We've certainly heard from telcos in North America and in Europe who make the same point.
Okay. Because obviously, providing an option here, I don't think is helpful. It doesn't promote comparability. But if it's going to promote comparability within a sector, in other words, if most telcos are going to do it across the globe, I guess I can live with it. As opposed to North American telcos are saying to do it, but the European.
I'm not sure we have sufficient data to answer your question.
Well, in my mind, that would really be the only sound basis for allowing this then.
Well, it's the dual list.
The
dual list is the major reason.
I think we're just conscious that this is just. I mean, we have the same relief in principle between the two sets of proposals, and we landed on different dates. And I think for dual reporters, I just think that's unfortunate. And since we don't think it would have a significant effect, is this not something that we could just take that tension out of the system?
Yeah. It's like I said, I can live with it.
Anyway, Patrick, there is no guarantee that all entities will adopt IFRS 15 topic 606 at the same date. There is some early application. So anyway, it's quite difficult to make sure that during this transition phase we will have comparability. It will depend on the choice.
So can we support the staff's recommendation?
Was that to both questions? Nobody
objected?
Yes. Okay, it was both questions. So then the next area is, in effect, saying that the modified retrospective approach can be applied to contracts that are not completed, which is what it currently says, but that also it could be applied to all contracts. So in other words, that means that the definition of a completed contract wouldn't become, potentially, if you selected that option, it wouldn't be critical to the modified retrospective approach. And the rationale here was to take some tension out by the fact that the FASB has proposed to change the definition of completed contract, and we basically decided in September not to do that, although you're about to confirm that or otherwise. Maybe I got the questions in the wrong order. Anyway, so that's the proposal to make it to make effectively completed contracts. You can do it one of two ways.
Yeah.
A modified retrospective approach. Sorry,
Henry, was that the rationale for why you created that option? What you just described.
Well, I think the rationale is laid out in paragraph 40. There's a number of approaches, but it does. Effectively, it does mean that a dual lister could apply the modified retrospective approach under both IFRS and US GAAP and be unaffected by the fact that we have a different definition of a completed contract, albeit at the cost that they'd have to restate more contracts.
All right.
Everybody agrees.
And the final question. We wish to retain the existing definition of a completed contract.
Retain. Yes.
Okay.
That's 12, I think.
Yeah, I would prefer to have the definition.
Okay, 7E.
So, welcome Sung Ho to the revenue team and for the first time at the board table, I think, as well.
Good luck. Thank you. Agenda paper 7E deals with question 5 of the ED. The subtitle of the 5 is other topics. In question 5 of ED, the ISB asks the respondents if they agree with the decision not to amend IFRS 15 on the three topics of collectability and the measurement of non-cash consideration and the presentation of sales taxes. For these topics, the FASB proposed the separate amendment. But generally, the majority of the respondents agreed with the ISB decision with respect to these three topics. We'd like to ask whether the board members have any comments and whether they agree with staff recommendation in each topic in turn. First topic is collectability, the paragraph 15 of the paper. The FASB proposed amendment to the topic 606 and illustrative examples in order to clarify how an entity should assess collectability and when is the contract terminated? The ISV did not propose amendments because it concluded that the existing guidance in IFRS 15 and the explanatory material in the basis for conclusion are sufficient. Although a few respondents asked for more guidance, the majority have indicated that they agree with ISV's conclusion that the existing guidance is adequate and no changes to the standards are needed. Consequently, we recommend in paragraph 27 that the ISP affirms its decision not to amend the requirements of IFRS 15 on the collectability and contract termination. Do you agree?
Matt? Quick question. Do you agree with the outcome here that the FASB is essentially proposing would essentially produce the same result between our guidance and their revised guidance?
I think that's a difficult one, Pat. I think some of the feedback that I have seen to both boards would suggest in terms of collectability that we are trying to clarify the same basic point. I would say that what the FASB did was perhaps say more than what the ISB currently says in BC 46 of the standard, which explains paragraph 9A.
Right.
The FASB has had a lot of comment on this particular topic.
And is that supportive or not supportive?
I've definitely seen some concerns raised about the amendments that have been made. So, for example, one of the firm letters to the FASB suggested actually they let practice deal with this issue rather than actually have amendments to the standard.
That's one of I guess this is an issue that I would put in the same camp as the first one we discussed, which is this is whether you get into the model or not. In my mind, this is absolutely critical, similar to, you know, the number of performance obligations you're ultimately allocating transaction price to and then the pattern of revenue that you're going to be booking. So I have a strong preference to be on the same page with them here, irrespective if ultimately they conclude, based on their feedback, that maybe we should leave this alone. This is one where if you're going to allow more transactions into the model under IFRS compared, say, with what you would get under U.S. GAAP, then that in my mind would be a significant difference between the two models. At this stage, we don't really know.
Well, I think we're just trying to ease concerns about how you read paragraph 9E of the standard. I think some people were concerned that it really stopped more transactions than the board ever intended it to capture. Right. And I think a lot of people agree that BC 46, you know, once it's been highlighted to them, very much confirms how you're meant to read paragraph 9E. And that was the rationale the board had originally for not doing any standard setting on this.
Yeah, I was reacting to paragraph 22, and I, you know, when I read that, I had the exact same concern. And again, the national standard setters, accountancy bodies, these are organizations that have outreach and discussions with a lot of players, a lot of preparers. And, you know, if they have valid concerns, notwithstanding, for example, the one accounting firm that you mentioned on the other side of the issue, this is where I worry about whether or not this model can truly be labeled as a converged solution or to revenue recognition.
Patrick, could I just give you a bit of context on that paragraph 22? Because we did receive comment from quite a lot of constituents on this, and we have reflected all of that in this paper. But what is in 21 was very much the majority of the feedback. You know, we have listed all of those that did comment to the effect of disagreeing with us, i.e. what's in paragraph 22. But that was by no means a majority of any different type of constituent. We were just trying to be clear about which feedback came from where.
No, I appreciate that. Unfortunately, as I was saying earlier, I think it's unsound to assign a disproportionate amount of weight to a majority of letters when you have really bona fide or valid concerns from experts in this area.
But we have other experts in this area that have said that this.
I know, but because there's a difference of opinions, you know, that's what causes me or gives me pause. And without being able to confidently say you would really get to the same outcomes that, let's say, one board is simply taking what's in the basis and moving it into the standard, that troubles me much less than, in fact, the words would produce a different outcome. And without really having the benefit of all the analysis of their comment letters and their proposals, I don't feel warm and fuzzy saying, yeah, let's just go with the staff recommendation here. And then feeling that we really do have a converged model. That's my big concern. And I put this issue in the same camp as the PO, the performance obligation issue.
Very good.
I will not support any step to do more, regardless whether it will be converged or not. Because from beginning, the current requirement is already a mixture of different principles, different ideas. You know, the whole history is like this. Originally, we conclude, you know, it should be the amount to be entitled, you know, be a gross amount. And then, you know, at later stage, you know, FH board members, particularly one of them, suggest, you know, current practice is good, why we change? Then we bring back the credibility threshold and using as a gate to scoot out, you know, to kick out the, we call it non-genuine contract. It is okay, you know, step one. But the problem is we put two words, create problem. I will feel confused, genuine contract from the possible credit loss, that is ability and intention. And we put these four ideas together, it's already something, it's not so clear principle. Then naturally people will ask more questions and want more clarities and want to improve understanding. But in my view, it is hard to. Therefore, I will not support any changes.
I also agree with the staff's recommendation to stick with what we've proposed. I think that in this whole area, further to what Weigo's said, we've sort of walked on a tightrope, both boards sort of trying to get this right and not to have it become a huge deal really in the standard. It really started off being about how genuine contracts were. Yeah. And given that the majority of respondents, including experts, agree that the approach is the correct one, I think the risk of unintended consequences in this area is really high if we start tinkering more.
Okay. All right. So we agree.
That's 12.
12. This is for all three?
No, that's collective of the figures.
I, by the way, I'm on record as agreeing with the staff recommendation, but I really believe that the ISB should do more to try to come to the same conclusion as the FHB on this one.
But I'd like to add some observation based on that the comment letter analysis. All the respondents who disagree our proposal want us to follow the FASB proposal. Only half of them did so. Only the half of the respondents who agree for the, did not agree for the, our proposal, want us to the follow the PASB's approach. So that means that there's a few respondents who disagree our proposal, not necessarily lead to the
solution.
Yeah.
So, or at least the one on the table.
Okay.
Non-cash. A second topic. Is a non-cash consideration, paragraph 28. The FSB proposed amendment to the topic 606 and illustrate examples in order to specify that the measurement date for a non-cash consideration is the contract inception date, and the variable consideration constraint applies only to the variability resulting from reason other than the form of consideration. The ISB did not propose amendment to specify the measurement date because it concluded that the existing IFRS does not contain any specific requirements about the issue, and the decision made only in the context of IFRS 15 could have unintended consequences when applied other standards. A small number of respondents asked the ISB to specify a particular measurement date, but they were not consistent in the date proposed. The majority of the respondents indicated that they agree with the ISB's decision and reasoning, and agreed that this is unlikely to increase any existing diversity in practice. Consequently, we recommend in paragraph 42 that the ISB affirmed its previous decision not to amend the requirement of IFRS 15 on non-cash consideration. Do you agree?
Can I ask a question? I just want to confirm that the statement in paragraph 32 differs from the original staff analysis here, which is to say that in the basis for conclusion, the measurement date other than the contract exception date as proposed by the FASB would not be precluded. My recollection is we were going to preclude the inception date.
No, we did not.
No, we were very clear to say
that's one of the
that was a reading under 15, but there were other acceptable readings too. That was the point that we were very strongly tried to communicate in our basis.
But we did not preclude the FASB.
Yeah. Right. In the ED, I guess, we didn't propose amendments, but I thought in the original staff discussions, did we have that teed up? I thought my recollection was that was one of the things we were taking off the table, the inception date. Is that correct?
Well, my recollection is that when we originally worked through the issue, I think if we had been deliberating it on our own, the staff recommendation would have been to preclude the approach that the FASB proposed to require.
Right.
But because the FASB was proposing to require it, we decided and this decision is reflected in the ED, not to do anything, so not to preclude what the FASB was proposing to require, while also noting in the basis that we hadn't put any restrictions, so that the FASB would be one possibility but was not required. So this is no change from the ED.
Right, no change from the ED, right.
Right.
But I was anchoring it to the original paper, but you've explained it. No, my recollection is clear.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do we agree with staff recommendation?
The last topic is the presentation of sales taxes, paragraph 43. The FASB proposed an amend topic 606 to permit an entity as an account policy election to exclude amounts collected from customers for all sales and other similar types taxes from the transaction price. IFRS preparers already assess whether sales taxes are collected on behalf of third party. The majority of respondents indicated that they agree with ISB's decision not to propose an equivalent amendment to IFRS 15, because this could reduce comparability and create an exception to the revenue recognition model. Consequently, we recommend in paragraph 52 that the ISB affirm its previous decision not to amend or clarify the requirements of IFRS 15 on the presentation of sales taxes. Do you agree?
Okay, we agree.
That's everybody.
15.
Can I make just one comment that just about this paper? One thing I worried was in the paragraph 17. Just a moment. Paragraph 12. The one some accounting body noted that the latter part. The accounting body noted that if IFRS stakeholders consider the FASB's amendment to be helpful, then they might often be used in the practice. So it would seem that there is a little bit gained from not adopting the amendment by the FASB.
I think it's a bit dangerous idea. Currently, now we have only IS 18, and quite often accounting firm refers US GAAP because we don't have many rules, and the US GAAP have some guidance. So then I often asked if it's the case, even in the IFRS 15, if it is not 100% converged. And I clearly deny that, because if the wording itself is different, some guidance in the US GAAP cannot be the interpretation of the IFRS 15. So that point must be clarified in the IFRS literature. And we have to be quite clear that guidance in the US GAAP, which is different from ours, cannot be the interpretation or implementation guidance of the IFRS 15. We should be very clear on this.
Well, sorry, I would disagree with that, Taka, because there's no reason for us to say that whenever we have a different application, we should clarify in our standards.
Yeah, I take your point. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, final paper.
Agenda paper 7H, so this is not related to the deliberation, so it's a separate issue. Some stakeholders asked whether the variable consideration constraint must be applied when the consideration in a contract with a customer varies based on a future market price, for example, as in the case of a provisionally priced contract. This paper considers whether the variable consideration constraint applies to those situations.
Which paper?
7H.
The other one is
G
together tomorrow.
FNG tomorrow. As explained in paragraphs 9 to 11 of the paper, stakeholders are concerned about the challenge in estimating a market price that is not subject to a significant reversal, and also the usefulness of the resulting financial information, whereby an entity would probably recognize no or a small amount of revenue by applying the constraint in those cases. As laid out in paragraphs 13 to 20 of the paper, we think that the answer to this question to a large extent depends upon whether the entity's right to consideration is concluded as unconditional or not. If the entity's right to consideration is unconditional, the entity recognizes a receivable, and any changes in the amount of consideration would be dealt with in accordance with IFRS 9. In the provisionally priced contracts considered in the paper, the entity has satisfied its performance obligation and there is no uncertainty with regards to the entity's entitlement to the consideration. There is no event that needs to occur. The entity's right to consideration is therefore unconditional as understood by IFRS 15, and the entity therefore recognizes a receivable which is accounted for in accordance with IFRS 9. This conclusion is also consistent with the variable consideration guidance. The variability arising from market prices is different from the types of variability that the IASB considered when developing the guidance on variable consideration. Further, the future market price of the commodity does not affect the entity's entitlement to the consideration, but only affects the amount of consideration. Based on the analysis, do you agree with our analysis that variability arising solely from changes in market price would not be subject to the variable consideration constraint?
Yes.
I'm not convinced by this analysis. I agree that the entitlement exists in both cases, variable price based on market considerations or variable consideration based on a royalty, which is dependent on actions by the licensee. I'm not sure about the difference in nature of those market or changes. I mean, first, is it more predictable when it is market price as opposed to the sales that the licensee will do? Probably not. So in terms of the measurement difficulty, I think they are of the same nature. So I think the reason why we put a constraint on the licensees is the risk that revenue, which will be recognized based on estimates, will have to be reversed later on, which is not helpful for markets. And the nature of the variable, i.e. market price of a commodity or the sales that a licensee will do, which may be in a way also linked to some external factors, such as market prices of some commodities, by the way, I don't see a big difference, so big as to make a different accounting treatment, i.e. to have one constraint on one side and not the other one.
I mean, what we tried to bring out as the examples considered in IFRS 15 versus the provisionally priced contract is that in almost all the cases of variability considered in IFRS 15, there is some element of entity's performance involved.
Yeah.
Whereas in the case of a provisionally priced contract, there is absolutely no entity's performance remaining in those cases. So it's just the fluctuation in the market prices which remains.
Exactly. Or perhaps said more broadly even, it's in most of those other examples that are highlighted in the paper, something else, an event needs to happen. It might be the entity's performance, it might be an action by a customer, it might be an action by a third party.
Yeah.
And that's the distinction here. Actually, so in those examples, the entity doesn't actually know to what it is entitled.
Yeah.
But in this example, you could argue that the entity does know to what it's entitled. It's just, effectively, it doesn't know what its value is because it doesn't know what its price is. And that's why I think the non-cash consideration is actually a very interesting analogy here.
But
that's the distinction we're drawing, Philippe.
But in a license, I know that I'm entitled to, say, 2% of
something else.
I just don't know how to measure the 2%.
Yeah, but something else needs to happen. A sale needs to occur or something like that. So that's
In the mining industry, sometimes the price at which they buy the raw materials from the mining company and the refiner will have its own selling price once it has refined the metals. And this is what we trigger the price adjustment for the supplier. Mm-hmm. Is it really different from a licensee transforming a license into sales from, say, a fashion goods or whatever?
Sure. Thank you for the paper. I think it was very helpful. It certainly helped me with the clarity of my thinking as well, and I'd already thought a lot about the issue, so it's a very good paper. I like the analysis and I like the cut that's made. I think it results in a sensible distinction, and I particularly liked the comments that were made in paragraph 19 about the fact that you make a distinction between whether there's an entitlement to consideration or just a variation in the amount, and I thought that was a helpful distinction.
Mary.
I agree with the implicit message in this paper that we should not try to provide guidance on this issue at this point in time in our standard setting. I was skeptical going into the paper. I don't object to the staff's analysis, although I'm not sure if there are other ways that you can look at it, and I'm looking in particular at the FI police in the blue jacket down at the bottom of the table, because the paper was very clear about not saying that there was an embedded derivative, mm-hmm. and that should be assessed. And
that's
if
what the police said. We can't get
so I don't know in what circumstances you would need to consider that question or not. I don't think we should try and answer it today. I don't think we should try and answer it in finalizing our exposure draft. I think we have to monitor and decide at a point in time later whether or not we answer this. But I think this analysis gives us enough for saying we don't need to act in the context of revenue now.
I mean, what we've...
But I do want to leave a flag that, you know, that's not gone away forever and ever, this FI
aspect. I think I was going to step in after Raghav had done his introduction, but just to say, you know, this is an issue where we've become aware of some concerns, and obviously it is a tricky area. So, but we decided that it would be quite helpful to try and capture our considerations and to try to answer a very narrow question and not get into some of the issues just alluded to there, because we still think that was important. And so we thought, by trying to capture those thoughts in the paper, ask the ISB, does anybody strongly object to this, it would actually be helpful to practice in dealing with some of the issues that they're currently wrestling with. And that's why we've done this paper, and that's why we've gone down this approach, because I don't think people feel that any particular action is required, but it's, if you like, it's in the form of education to the market.
Well, and I was okay by the end of the paper with the staff conclusion that the variable consideration constraint is not in play in, you know, the same way. As I said, I you know, recognizing the very careful analysis that you did within the parameters you were given. I just don't want to send a signal that there's a conclusion that IS 39, IFRS 9 does not apply.
Again, my point, I'm not saying that we must give guidance now, but again, if a mining company sells raw materials to a smelter, a metal smelter, and is entitled to 20% of the revenue of that smelter as a consideration for the raw materials, and this 20% is based on whatever price the smelter will be able to sell the copper or zinc, whatever, which will be based on market prices. Is a 20% entitlement in any way different from 20% of the sales of a shop under a license or sales of a shop under a lease agreement? I said 20% could be 5, could be 2%, I don't care, just take 20% as a
sample. I think events need to happen in that example. So I think
the
it's different.
The
sales have to happen.
But the shop as well,
your
lease
right.
remuneration.
This is different. Happened, the only variation is the future market price.
Exactly. Yeah, I've sold, but I am entitled to receive cash. Only if the smelter sells.
In this example, I've transferred the commodity to you today. And so my performance obligation is over. And you only agreed to pay.
In your lease, I have transferred the right of use of the lease, so I don't have anything to do.
If you're talking about, say, a lease where there's a rental that's based on the turnover of the store, I think we're drawing a distinction there, saying it's different, because I think there's events need to happen, sales need to occur.
It isn't, and Philippe, my understanding is in the provisional pricing contracts, and I wouldn't be surprised if they vary, but at least some of them, it isn't necessarily the smelter's sales price achieved, but it may be a commodity market reference
steel
price.
Sales at market price.
Right, but it isn't. There isn't a. I'm taking an interest in your future sales. It's the amount that you will pay me is based on whatever the market price is.
It's 100 just linked to future commodity prices.
Yeah.
Or something.
You don't settle at the spot on the day you settle.
Very simple. On this, on the Philippe side, actually during the small group meeting of last month, I also expressed similar view.
In the smelter group meeting. Okay, can we support the staff's recommendation?
Okay, so that's 11.
11?
Okay.
Okay.